Have you ever met someone and you just instantly felt a connection with them and wanted to hang out with them? I'll bet you've also had an instance where you felt the opposite. Everyone gives off vibes. Parents do it, teachers do it, and it has an impact on the people around them. So I know this doesn't sound very scientific, but you're going to find out today that it actually is. This is LD Expert Live. Welcome to the LD Expert Podcast, your place for answers and solutions for dyslexia, learning, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers and author of a brand new book, Take the Stone Out of the Shoe, a must-have guide to understanding, supporting, and correcting dyslexia, learning, and attention challenges. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens have more difficulty than expected in school. It provides simple, practical tools for supporting struggling students at home and in the classroom. Most importantly, it presents real solutions and the science behind them. We talk a lot about kids because our heart is with making life better for struggling students. Well, students of any age, actually. But you, parents and teachers, you're the ones who really have to hold everything together. So today, we're going to be talking about self-regulation and resilience for parents and teachers. In other words, how you can keep your cool and take care of yourself so that you can help your struggling learners achieve the academic and social success you're looking for. Our guests today are Rick and Doris Bowman. They are coming to us from just outside of Portland, Oregon. Rick has a master's degree in clinical psychology, and Doris has a master's in special education. They both have spent more than 20 years in education with a focus on serving children and teens who struggle with learning, behavioral, and emotional and mental health challenges. Rick and Doris are certified HeartMath trainers, including providing the Resilience Advantage, which is used to train professionals from the medical, business education, professional athletics, first responder, and military fields. We use HeartMath with students at Stowell Learning Centers, and it is pretty amazing stuff. I kind of nerd out on the physiological connections behind it all. So I'm really excited that Rick and Doris are here to share their expertise with us and to give you some simple strategies that you can use. Rick and Doris are certified trauma practitioners and certified trainers in collaborative problem solving. And they present at conferences and train educational and mental health agencies all over the country. We are so honored to have you today. Welcome, Doris and Rick.
Thanks, Jill.
Thank you, Jill.
You know, as Lauren said, being a parent, especially at this time, is challenging. I mean, being a parent is the most wonderful thing in the world, but it's also hard. My husband is fond of saying, as soon as you bring your newborn home, you realize how little control you actually have.
So true.
Parents, you just want everything to be just right for your kids. And when they struggle, you know, you kind of beat yourself up, maybe feel like a failure. And unfortunately, those feelings don't really help our kids. So I know, Doris, you can relate to this as a mom.
Absolutely, Jill. We have four children. And in particular, I think relating to a lot of the families that might be viewing today is that our daughter, our youngest, had really significant learning disability. By the end of third grade, really could not read, functionally read at all. And you can imagine, as an educator and a special educator, I felt this unbelievable burden that I should be able to find the right answer for her. And, you know, her intelligence tested within the average range, and we had tried every technique and tool that schools were typically using at that time. She's now 30, so it's been a few years. But at that time, we found that we lived in Southern Oregon and found that in Portland, there was a reading clinic that was using a multisensory approach. And we spent a whole summer driving back and forth to Portland and spending the week in Portland at the reading clinic with her getting about 4 hours a day of intensive reading instruction. And the great news to have a hopeful end to this story is that she really became a reader in about 8 weeks. She made 2 years of reading progress on a Woodcock Johnson standardized assessment and went on to get her standard high school diploma. And so I think that was a real, a success story of if you find the right thing, you know, this can happen. But at the time, honestly, the neuroscience at that time told us if your child wasn't reading by age 7, you probably missed the window. And right. I felt like a complete and utter failure. And so I now understand that much of what I was feeling was what we're going to be talking about today as overcare. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, parents want to do what's best for their kids. We're all striving to do what we feel is best, but it can be really hard to maintain our own regulation. And so, and the same with educators. You know, I really identify with the educators on the call that we see where, you know, more and more children are struggling with issues of regulation, self-regulation, emotional regulation. And so for all of us, I think some of the things that we can hopefully help with today is kind of an understanding that depleting emotions that we're experiencing, even for a good reason, that, you know, our concern is we have a healthy concern for our child, but those depleting emotions that we're experiencing can be contagious. Our own level of regulation can be contagious. And so we have to work proactively on our own level of resilience and self-regulation so that we can help our child or student.
You know, it sounds like the first step to helping our kids have more regulation or control over their emotions and behavior is to understand and have control over our own.
Yeah, absolutely.
How does that work? I mean, what's the science behind that?
Yeah, well, it's exciting. You know, there's really great science behind it now. And for us, that's so meaningful because I think a lot of us have felt over time like, oh, other people pick up on our emotions, or we haven't really understood, like, how does that happen? And so it's just this kind of mystical woo-woo thing, right? Like you walk in a room and you're around somebody who makes you feel uplifted, right? Or you know, those kinds of things. And so now we know that that this is a very concrete, research-based, physiological process that we can be proactive about. And so we want to look at resilience and really look at the fact that our typical view of resilience has been kind of a reactionary way of defining it. You know, if I ask a large room of people, how would you define resilience? Most people are going to define it as overcoming some really big challenge, right? Someone overcame a difficult childhood, or they overcame being in a big natural disaster or something like that. But we really want to promote a redefined way of looking at resilience. And this is the definition that does come from HeartMath. And this is how they define it: the capacity to prepare for, recover from, or adapt in the face of stress, adversity, trauma, or challenge. And so when we think about this, what we're looking at is that we can take steps to proactively build our resilience. There are four different domains of resilience. There's the physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual. And generally, all of us have, you know, a strength in one of these areas, an area where we feel like we're doing pretty well and pretty solid, and then other areas that maybe are weaknesses. And so as we look at increasing our resilience, we need to increase in all of these areas and create balance, right? And when we look at this, then one of the important concepts that we want to share and we'll be referencing a little bit is that our bodies are energy systems. And so our bodies expend and renew energy. And what we find is that it's in the emotional domain where we tend to experience a lot of emotional energy drains, a lot of losing our energy to emotions that we're going to term depleting emotions. And so, as you can see here, where all four of these domains come together at the center is the word coherence. And coherence is key. Where all of these domains come together is this concept of coherence. And Rick is going to share more about what is coherence and how does it influence our resilience and our ability to self-regulate.
So let's define coherence. Coherence is when the nervous system, the immune system, the hormonal systems are in energetic coordination, as well as the mind, the heart, and the emotions, and our emotions are in sync as well. And so we're going to talk a lot about the idea that in the past, we've thought about thoughts being so important. And what we find is that emotions are actually faster than thoughts. The way that the central nervous system is wired, the way the brain is wired, is that many of our emotions then can access our autonomic nervous system and our brain before thoughts can. And so emotions are move quicker than thoughts. And then oftentimes when we experience the emotion in our body, what we then do is assign a thought to that emotion. So the next thing I want to talk about is this thing called the heart-brain connection. So the heart has its own nervous system. And we find that the heart actually communicates with the brain constantly. And what we know is that the heart sends more messages to the brain than the brain sends to the heart. We also know that the heart messages are always received by the brain. And sometimes the heart kind of just disregards the messages from the brain. Now, another important point here that I want to make is that our autonomic nervous system is responsible for 90% of our bodily processes. And of course, the heart is connected to that autonomic nervous system. And so any emotion that we feel changes activity in the autonomic nervous system and has an effect on all of our bodily systems. So here we're not just talking about our emotions and our thinking. We're also realizing that the emotions that we have are actually affecting our health as well as our ability to self-regulate. So what you're looking at here are renewing emotions and depleting emotions. And so if you look at the slide that says coherence, what we're looking at here are what we would call coherent heart rhythms. And when you are experiencing these type of heart rhythms, and these heart rhythms can be measured by a heart rhythm monitor, what you're actually experiencing at this time are renewing emotions. And when you're experiencing these coherent wave-like heart rhythm patterns, then you're experiencing renewing emotions such as appreciation, gratitude, kindness, compassion, love. And when that happens, what actually happens is that these heart rhythms then allow the heart to send messages to the brain that synchronizes the entire brain, such as the cortex and other areas of the brain. And when we have a synchronized brain, then we are able to think clearly, problem solve, and self-regulate our emotions. When we are experiencing depleting emotions such as frustration, anger, anxiety, worry, fear, then these are the type of heart rhythm patterns that we see. And these heart rhythm patterns then cause the heart to send incoherent messages to the brain. And so in these situations where we're having these depleting emotions, then the brain cannot synchronize these messages. And basically what happens is we don't have full access to our cortex. And you probably know what happens when we don't have full access to our cortex, right?
Yeah.
It's like driving with one foot on the brake and one foot on the gas pedal.
Right.
We can say and we can do anything. And kids are like this, right? And oftentimes what we're seeing here is that the kids are experiencing these depleting emotions. Maybe it's about school, for example. Maybe it's about something that's going on at home that they dislike or they're upset about. And when this is happening, they lose access to their cortex, mm-hmm. and therefore we see a lot of lack of regulation. And at that particular point, whether we're adults or we're children, we can show any type of challenging behavior and say about anything.
Right. So our system basically operates kind of on a spectrum. We're either in coherence, which is calm and rational, or some degree of incoherence, with the total opposite being fight or flight. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the distressing behaviors that we see in children who are overloaded are those fight or flight behaviors: running, hiding, screaming, anger, meltdowns, or just shutting down. Mm-hmm. And as you said, when they're in that state, they're not in their rational brain. So trying to problem solve with them at that point is not really going to work. And adults are like that too. I mean, when we get overloaded, it might look a little bit different, but it's still fight or flight, lashing out, sarcasm, the silent treatment. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought that was really interesting what you said about the emotions being quicker than thought and our heart sending so many messages to the brain. You know, parents have been in a position in the last several months where they have had to teach their kids at home. And it sounds like in a lot of places, there is still going to be remote learning when school starts. And I think so many parents, you know, you see on social media, parents just pulling their hair out and beating themselves up that they don't feel effective teaching mm-hmm. their kids. But that emotional connection, I mean, it's so much easier for us, for teachers who are not, you know, the parent, to, you know, to work with kids. I mean, I remember my own son, you know, I would try to work with him and he would, "That's not how my teacher does it."
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember that exact line. Mm-hmm.
This is what I do for a living. I know this, uh-huh. but the emotional connection. So I think, you know, absolutely learning how to be aware of it and have some control over it is going to be incredibly valuable as mm-hmm. parents head into this new school year. But thinking about, you know, that coherence or incoherence, and how does that affect people around us? Because you talked a little bit about coming into a room and, you know, wow, you know, this person, they make me feel good, you know, or this person makes me feel agitated. How does that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, the thing about it is we've always said that it takes a regulated adult to regulate a child. And in this case, it takes a coherent adult mm-hmm. to help a child become more coherent. And you can kind of look at coherence and regulation as in some ways synonymous, because you're not going to be regulated unless you're coherent. I just want to show you this particular study. But before saying that, I'm going to say that our coherence, our ability to be coherent, affects everybody around us, especially our children, and even each other as well. And so how does this happen? Well, one of the things I want to say first is that every time that our heart beats, we produce electricity. And our heart produces more electricity than any other organ in our body. And so when electricity is produced, it always creates an electromagnetic field. Now, this is just basic physics. So we know that the heart creates this electromagnetic field, and that magnetic field is a carrier wave of information. And so in this particular study, they put four people together, three of which had been trained for 2 weeks in how to use a strategy to become coherent. And then the fourth person down at the bottom had no training, didn't know what the study was about. And they set these four people together at a table, and they instructed three of the people that had been trained to go into a coherent state. Took them a minute or two to go into a coherent state, even though they'd only been trained for 2 weeks. Once the three people went into the coherent state, guess what happened? The fourth person became coherent. So it was this coherent energy, this information that they were sending out, that other person was able to experience. The interesting thing about this is that, as most of us know, sometimes we can feel the energy of other people. And what the research shows is we can either consciously know, feel that energy, if not consciously, we can experience it unconsciously as well. And so here just goes along that if we can use consistent practices, we can create a new baseline for ourselves to help us become more coherent. And that coherence is going to help other people, our children, our students, become more coherent and more regulated as well. So basically, we know that that this field around us, and when we are in renewing emotions, we are going to be able to create a coherent field that's going to affect others. When we're in depleting emotions, that's also going to affect our children and students as well. And what happens is we say that we're going to come into entrainment with each other. In other words, our emotions are going to line up with each other.
And can I add something real quick?
Absolutely.
I was just thinking about this concept of baseline. When we think about creating a new baseline, we kind of think of that as it becoming your new norm. And so what it essentially refers to is that not only by using these practices consistently, not only can you become more coherent at the time you're using the practice, but it actually repatterns your nervous system so that coherent state becomes your norm. It becomes essentially like your resting state. And so I think that's a big part of the power of this, is that it not only gives us something to use in a crisis or in a very challenging moment, but gives us a way of over time becoming less reactionary, becoming more regulated as our standard course of who we are and who we bring to the people that we love and care about and serve and teach.
Absolutely. You know, I remember I was teaching a seminar to educators and learning center directors, and they had come from all over the country. So I had some people and the seminar started at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I had some people who had been driving through Southern California traffic. I had some people who were, you know, from the East Coast, and they had gotten in, you know, very, very late their time the night before. And so there was this room full of people that were at all different states of incoherence, kind of. Mm-hmm. And there was this one woman who actually lives in kind of a meditation community. And in that community, people, you know, they spend a great deal of time meditating and being, you know, in coherence, doing a lot of yoga, and amazing, amazing woman. And she walked into this room with everybody chatting and a little bit agitated in their own, you know, state of sleep deprivation or whatever. And she walked in and the whole room just took a breath. I mean, she didn't say a word. She walked in the room and everyone just, because her natural way of being, you know, that she had developed over all these years was this calm, coherent state. And it impacted the entire room. It was amazing to see, for me, from the standpoint of standing in front and watching the response of everyone as she walked in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I'm sure that was, I mean, I suspect that that was probably a very conscious choice on her part too, that she wasn't only being in her own coherence, right? But she was purposefully, and we're going to talk about this and actually demonstrate, but where she was purposefully, you know, influencing others, using that. And there's nothing woo-woo again about this, right? This is not some, like, you know, it's about your aura or whatever. This is literally, like, we can measure this with, you know, instruments that measure the electromagnetic field that comes out from someone who's extremely coherent. And I'm betting that she was purposefully, right, just influencing those around her.
She may very well have been. Yeah. It was really fun to see. It's just such fascinating stuff. Yeah. Now, I'm sure that people are really anxious to hear how to build their own self-regulation and coherence. This is LD Expert Live. I'm Jill Stoll, and today we're talking to Rick and Doris Bowman about increasing self-regulation and resilience for educators, parents, and kids, while also improving academic performance. So let's get to the how. How do we achieve better emotional regulation and coherence? What strategies do you have for us today?
Okay, we're going to show you a strategy here. Well, we're going to walk you through a strategy here in just a couple of minutes. But I want to first talk about care versus overcare. And we've kind of been talking about that. So if you're teaching remotely, if you're going to be teaching online, that's going to be pretty stressful. I mean, that would be stressful for all of us. The times that we're living in right now are extremely stressful. And we know that how much parents care about their children. We know how much teachers care about their students. And what we want to talk about for just a second is that oftentimes our care is balanced at first, and then we go into this thing called overcare. And overcare is when we go into a state of we go into a state where we're experiencing stress, anxiety, fear, frustration, some of the things that you're seeing up on the slide right now. And it's because we have shifted from really that balanced care to placing too much significance on the problem. And so any time that we've shifted from care to overcare, we're experiencing some of these emotions that you're seeing on the slide, as well as we're depleting our energy. And when we're experiencing these type of emotions, of course, we are in a state of incoherence and dysregulation. So again, when we're in this state of overcare, then we lack regulation, and it is again felt by the child, which results in more dysregulation of the child. And so we, as parents, as teachers, can practice simple strategies, and we have several of them, to take the significance out of the problem so that we can approach the problem in a more coherent and regulated way. And Doris mentioned this earlier, not only when we're doing this is that we're developing a new baseline in our brain, in that fight flight part of our brain, for dealing with situations which trigger overcare responses. And so these overcare responses then may be related to our child. They may be related to the school. They may be related to people in our life or places or things as well. But once we use these strategies, we can actually repattern the baseline in the our baseline responses of our amygdala and become more coherent and regulated. And so Doris is going to walk you through a strategy that will help with that.
And the strategy that we're going to share with you today is called Heart Lock-In. And like I said before, there are over a dozen strategies that pertain to specific purposes. This particular technique or strategy is often used for a couple of purposes. One is to repattern a new nervous system baseline, but the consistent use of this over time, and we have some guidelines for, you know, what's suggested and so forth, but can repattern our nervous system. The other is the use for co-regulation. As Rick described, this is actually the technique that he would often use prior to and as he would go into a classroom setting to generate this co-regulation among the students. And so we're going to do this heart lock-in technique together. And there are a couple of things I want to do as a lead into this. One is that I want to encourage you to identify before we start a renewing emotion that you feel that you can generate and actually feel it in your heart. And so sometimes a helpful, this can be hard to do when you're first doing it in a purposeful, proactive kind of way. But often thinking of someone that you love or care about, it could be a family member or a friend, it could be a pet, thinking of a place that you love, that you really feel joy or ease or calm when you're in that place, maybe a past accomplishment or memory that is really positive that you're really grateful for. And so, and a couple of the emotions that seem the easiest for people to experience when they first start doing this are often appreciation, care, or gratitude. So most of us can think of something that will help us generate those emotions. So one, hopefully you can think of something here that you kind of hang on to. And we're going to walk through this process. We're going to start with what we call heart-focused breathing. And essentially that is to center our attention in the area of the center of our chest where the heart area is. And we're going to focus on breathing as if we're breathing in and out of that area where our heart is. And again, that has to do with the fact that the energy that's generated from the heart, having our attention there, is where our energy goes. And so then we're going to activate and sustain this renewing emotion. And then we're going to essentially send this renewing emotion out through the electromagnetic field again. This is just like your cell phone, guys. Nothing weird about it. Your heart is sending out an electromagnetic field that has waves, just like carrier waves, just like a cell phone. And those carrier waves can carry that emotional signal, that emotional signature from your heart. So we're going to walk through this process, and I'll just have us hold it for about a minute when we get to the activate and sustain and radiate. And then we'll jump back in here to some more chatting, but hopefully this will give you a sense of what we're talking about, how simple it is, how you can do it anywhere, and yet know that it is research-backed and scientifically demonstrated to be effective. So let's go ahead, and I'll invite you, as long as you're not driving, please don't do this if you're driving, I'll invite you to close your eyes. And the reason we do that, again, isn't because this is some, you know, spiritual practice. This is because it blocks out sensory input. So we're going to close our eyes and focus our attention in the area of the heart. And if it helps you to focus there, sometimes I put my hand right there just to help me stay centered there. And so focus your attention in the area of the heart. And imagine that your breath is flowing in and out of the heart area or chest area, breathing just a little bit slower and deeper than usual. Now activate and sustain a regenerative or renewing emotion, such as appreciation, care, or compassion for someone, something that you love, a place that you love. And just really feel that emotion in your heart and sustain that feeling. And now radiate that renewing feeling first throughout your entire body. Imagine it coming out from your heart, throughout each of the cells of your body, each of the organs of your body, to your brain, and then radiate beyond you to others that you care for, that you love, those around you, those in your community. And let's continue to sustain and radiate this for about 1 minute. Okay, I'll invite you back. And so hopefully you were able to feel a little bit of a physiological shift in doing that. But what we know is that by using this practice over time, that we can become very effective at establishing our own resilience, at repatterning our baseline, and then also creating co-regulation with those around us.
Well, I feel amazing now. Thank you for that. You know, I was thinking about the fact that, you know, even if schools are back in on site, they will most likely, hopefully, be socially distanced. And so this would be an amazing way to start mm-hmm. a class, whether you're on site or remote with on a, you know, a Zoom class or something, just to acknowledge that, you know, we have to be kind of distanced from each other right now, but we can give this gift to ourselves mm-hmm. and each other, mm-hmm. you know,
yes,
wherever we are. So that was
that sense of connection that everyone's longing for right now, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
that was amazing.
Yeah. And I should say too, Jill, that, you know, you don't have to close your eyes to do this. It can be done anywhere. You could do it in the middle of a classroom of kids and just stand in a spot for a few seconds and just do this process. Or I used to do it often in my car between driving between two schools, right? And I know mm-hmm. I'm going through a challenging situation and I just begin using this practice, eyes open. So it can be used anywhere in any setting, which is one of the wonderful and powerful things about it is that, you know, you don't have to go off to a retreat. You don't have to have a whole hour to go take a break somewhere. And it's still very effective.
And by the way, some families do this before they have a meal together, or they just, you know, sit down in the evening before they go to bed and they do some heart math strategies so that everybody is coherent and regulated, because it is extremely helpful with sleep as well.
Yes, I can see how that would be. You know, I was thinking about how sometimes kids and parents just get into automatic patterns of response, you know, like as soon as it's school time or homework time, the child maybe gets whiny. And whether the work is hard or not, it's just sort of a pattern that they've built up.
Yes.
And then things escalate because we're in a pattern. And it's really encouraging to hear you say that we can repattern some things. But can you talk a little bit about how this might apply to a situation like that?
Yes, absolutely. And so I think this kind of leads into the little bit about the strategy we wanted to share from collaborative problem solving. And so I know Jill shared that we are collaborative problem solving trainers and train this approach to educators and mental health clinicians and other folks who work with families and children, even adults. And as we look at this slide, I think one of the most powerful things, Jill, with what you're talking about is that if we as the adult can engage in a new pattern of interaction, that can break that established pattern of, you know, where, you know, okay, it's time to do your math assignment. And the child immediately starts moving into, because they have this anticipation and it's this very patterned response and interaction that takes place. And generally, maybe it's, let's say, escalating into, I'd rather, you know, go into an emotional response than I don't really have the skills and what it takes to handle the frustration of this work, for example. And so by engaging a child in this sequence of engagement that we see here on the slide, this is what we call a proactive plan B in collaborative problem solving. And what you can see is that there are three steps to this interaction, starting at the bottom and moving our way up. And the reason they start at the bottom and move their way up is that it follows in the brain. We have to start with that lower brain and regulating the child before we can move on to talking about the concerns and trying to solve the problem. And so in this plan B interaction, then, what we are doing is we are first coming in with empathy and saying, gosh, you know, I can see this is something about this is really hard for you. Can you help me understand? And they may at first be like, what the, you know, this is not the way you normally interact with me. And it may take a few times before they trust that, no, you really are genuinely interested in understanding what's hard for them. Then we share our adult concerns. So they may say, well, it's just math always takes me too long. Okay, so it feels like it takes a really long time. Yeah, I mean, it feels like it takes forever. Wow, I hear you. That would be really hard. I can see why that could be frustrating. And so my concern is that, you know, if we don't get through the math, you might fall behind. And when you fall behind, that feels really stressful. It could be really frustrating. And so I'm wondering if there's a way, and then you move to step number three, that we can come up with a solution for this, an idea that we can try that would meet your concern of this seems like it takes forever, and my concern of if you don't get the work done, then you might fall further behind. Or, you know, this could be about chores. This could be, you know, taking out the trash. And their concern is they don't like to go outside after dark and take the trash out because after dinner it's dark. And your concern is that the kitchen gets kind of stinky and it affects everybody in the family, right? So now we're collaborating on. But the important thing to understand is this is not negotiating and this is not compromising. Our solution needs to meet the concerns of both the child and the parent, or the child and the teacher. And so, but the really powerful thing about this is that in the process of engaging in this pattern, not only are we working to solve the issue, but we are actually activating the neural pathways in the brain that are involved in the neurocognitive skills that the child may be lagging in or lacking. So their flexibility, their ability to tolerate frustration, their ability to stick with a task, their ability to ignore irrelevant things going on around them, their ability to problem solve. And so we know that we have a lot of research to back up the fact that this particular very simple process, but has some real, you know, uniquenesses and complexities to it as well, can take you to that place. Of being able to solve the problems, but also building those skills, and really increasing the child's skill set over time. So that, think about, I always like to ask folks, parents and kids, do you want to be following him around when he's 29, solving his problems for him? And if you don't, we need to build those skills. And so taking an approach that builds the skills is very empowering and proactive.
Absolutely. I love that. That was so helpful. Thank you so much. Man, that was good stuff. I mean, if there was ever a time when we all need strategies for emotional control and supporting the people in our lives better, it's now.